All right, take two. So welcome everybody. Glad to have you here as we continue with our Megillas Esther series. Last week we focused on Ahasuerus, and so what better topic to tackle this week than Vashti, as we just moved through Perek Aleph. I think next week we'll probably do Mordechai and Esther. I think we're going to have to squeeze and do both of them in 1 week, and then we'll do Haman and Amalek in week four, and God willing we will do the end of the Megillah in week five. So when we talk about Vashti, and before even getting the source sheet up there, there's not that much of a source sheet to have from a particular perspective. You know, Vashti has only a few psukim. I mean, she's very, very little attention. Last week, we like the chiddush of last week's shiur was that Ahasuerus, despite being so pervasive in the Megillah, does almost nothing. And we took a step back and we're like, what does Ahasuerus actually do? And said he throws a couple of parties, he raises a tax, and then he delegates everything else to his lackeys. He decides who those lackeys are going to be or not going to be, but everyone else was doing everything. Haman, Mordechai, Esther, Memuchan, Harvona, everyone else was deciding what to do. Ahasuerus does nothing. This week with Vashti, she actually does almost nothing. I mean, she has like a few psukim in the beginning of Perek Aleph. That's it. And yet, for whatever reason, and tonight maybe we'll get some of a handle why, she really captures the imagination. You know, anybody who reads the Megillah, Vashti just stands out as a character who we feel like this is, there's something interesting there. There's something beating. There's something below the surface. It's just a few psukim. The Mefarshim certainly saw that in the same way. And as we'll also see, Chazal were all over Vashti as well, and for very good reason. So we're going to try to extract and try to unpack what is it about this mysterious personality. We're going to see there are vastly different perspectives in the truth in Chazal already to some degree, for sure in the Mefarshim, ranging from looking at Vashti as the worst of the worst, Haman in female queen form, to looking at Vashti as a misunderstood, noble, modest heroine, almost like an Esther 1.0. So we're gonna look at some of that, and hopefully we're gonna at towards the end of this year really try to develop one particular approach towards Vashti, which I think emerges from one way to look at the Megillah and one way to look at some of the major midrashim. So with that as the background, let's load up the source sheet. Here we go. All right, Vashti, the road to oblivion. Which okay, good. Spell that correctly this time. So psukim, here we have, right? Vashti, four psukim, all of it, we're told about Ahasuerus' party. Vashti makes her own. She's told to come and she refuses. Vashti refuses to come to the party. It's the only thing she does in the Megillah. She doesn't actually do anything. I mean, I guess she does two things. She makes a party in Pasuk Tes, and she refuses to come to Ahasuerus' party in Pasuk Yud-Beis. That's it. Those are the only two things that happen that she does in the Megillah. So the challenge is going to be, how can we construct a personality? How can we really get an understanding of who Vashti was and what she stood for and what we should learn from her when we have two psukim to deal with? She does two things. She makes a party and she refuses to come. Well, the good news is that both of these are, oh yeah, someone wants you to post in the chat. Sure, we'll definitely do that. One second. Just gonna load up. How do I do that? Yeah. My computer. Okay, perfect. Chat, the source sheet is in the chat. Great. Now, so it happens to be that those two things that Vashti does, making a party and really not coming to the party, are things that we really can unpack, because both of those are very significant steps to take. And especially the second one, refusing to come to the party, it's one of those things, one of the many, many things in the Megillah that we take for granted because we know the story so well. But if we take even half a step back, Vashti doing this is shocking. V'timain hamalkav Vashti levo b'dvar hamelech, refusing to come as the king commanded. Right, and note that the Megillah doesn't just say that Vashti refuses to come. Michal could have just said, Vatima ein hamalka Vashti lavo. It could have said she refused to come. We would know exactly what that means. But the Megillah tells us that she refused to come bidvar hamelech asher biyad hasarisim. She refused to come to the king's word. This is the king's command, which was sent by the sarisim, sent by the eunuchs or the chamberlains, the officials who were sent to pick her up. The one rule in the Megillah, one rule in ancient Persia is Achashverosh's word is law. You don't ignore what Achashverosh tells you to do. Now, you can manipulate what Achashverosh wants to do. You can control Achashverosh. But when Achashverosh wants something done, anybody does it. Because anybody who doesn't, he snaps his finger and they're a dead man. Vashti doing this is crazy. It's virtually suicidal what Vashti does. Just ignoring the king's command. And so the obvious question that the Mefarshim all have to ask is why on earth would Vashti refuse to come? You know, on one level, that's just, why not? Why wouldn't she come? But the deeper question is, there's got to be something really driving her. This is not just an ordinary refusal. It is an insane thing to do. It is crazy that she is doing this, and we've got to figure out why. We'll see, there are like four main streams of thought here in the Mefarshim. One, probably the funniest one, honestly, which is great. You know, anything which is funny fits the pshat in the Megillah because Megillah's Esther. Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra basically says, whoops. So he has two suggestions, but his first one, his second one, actually, I love his second suggestion, says Ibn Ezra, Chashva shehu shikur. Vashti thought that Achashverosh was drunk. Now, Vashti was correct. Achashverosh was drunk. What's Ibn Ezra saying? Let's imagine Vashti's been married to Achashverosh for a few years now. This is not the first time, probably, that Vashti has received some crazy, insane request from Achashverosh when he's drunk, which he's drunk all the time. Right, not the first time. So, okay, you know, yesterday he sent a message asking me to, I don't know, send him 50 dogs. And 2 days ago, he said some other crazy thing. Today, he wants me showing up in front of his palace officials at my party. He's drunk. It's not a serious request. Ignore it. He'll wake up in the morning. He's not going to remember what happened. Just, you know, ladies, enjoy our party. Stay on our side. Don't worry about my husband. He's kind of an embarrassment. He's getting out of control. Just ignore it. He's drunk, right? So the advantage that shot has is it certainly fits Achashverosh's profile of somebody who is drunk, somebody who in Perek Beis will sober up and he will be like, wait, what was it that happened yesterday? What? Vashti, huh? So it fits and explains why Vashti would dare say no. As Ibn Ezra is going to say, this has happened all the time. It's just a misunderstanding. She thought he was drunk. Now, if that's the case, the problem with that is that that answer leaves us with nothing to hold on to about reconstructing Vashti's personality. Now, if it was just a kind of comedic misunderstanding, then, well, I know that stinks for Vashti, but too bad. Let's move on with the Megillah. There's nothing really for us to learn if this is the case. Now, Ibn Ezra himself isn't going to be bothered by that. Ibn Ezra can tell us, yeah, it's not Megillah's Vashti, it's Megillah's Esther. You guys should have a shir on Achashverosh, have a shir on Haman and Mordechai and Esther. Don't waste your time Tuesday night having a 45-minute shir on Vashti. That's what Ibn Ezra is going to say. But okay, you know, other Mefarshim disagreed, and that's why that's what we're talking about tonight. So let's go and see what are some of the other main perspectives if we're not just going to say whoops. So you have a whole school, very interesting perspectives over here, who think that there was a major political background. It wasn't just a random request for Achashverosh to command his wife to appear in all of her beauty before his different officials. There was a political element to the request, and Vashti is very well aware. And this is taken in different ways. The Rashbam says, well, hold on a second. You know, before, I'm going to scroll up back to the Pesukim for a second. Before in the Pesuk, we made a big deal about the fact that the Megillah told us that Vashti refused lavo bidvar hamelech. And we suggested then that the Megillah was emphasizing the fact that this is a royal command. And how dare Vashti refuse the Dvar HaMelech, the royal command. Truth is, though, the next phrase in the Megillah is also redundant. When the Megillah said, Asher biyad hasarisim, the commandment which was sent by the sarisim. We know that already. The Megillah told us a couple of psukim ago. Ahasuerus is drunk. He's together with his sarisim. And he told them, the king told, right, Mehuman, Bizza, etc., etc., Shivas tasarisim. He told them to bring Vashti to the king. So if we're told in Pasuk Yud Aleph, that Ahasuerus tells his sarisim, bring Vashti, why in Pasuk Yud Beis does the Megillah need to tell us once again that this commandment was sent from the sarisim? That's the piece in the pasuk that the Rashbam jumps onto with both hands, and he's going to begin opening up this perspective for us. And the Rashbam's understanding was that Ahasuerus was specifically sending a lower level delegation. He was sending the palace chamberlains. He was sending the eunuchs. He was sending his body servants. He was not sending the defense minister and the foreign minister and the finance minister. He wasn't sending the most impressive, cabinet officials or senators. He was sending his in-house sarisim, and Vashti felt that that was an insult. He was sending the sarisim amashar sim panav velo biyad hapartimim. Later on in the Megillah, we'll find about other officials. There are many, many royal officials in Persia, and the Rashbam understands that Ahasuerus is sending lower level officials. Now, even if that is the case, there are two main ways, according to this interpretation, of understanding Vashti's conduct: a more sympathetic way and a more critical way. The Ralbag takes the more critical perspective. The Ralbag says this is just petty ego. He says this is Gava, that she wanted to be invited to the party. She has no problem coming to the party at all, says Ralbag. The problem was, I'm the queen. You don't send a message to the queen with your, D-level officials. I am Vashti. I want the high-level officials. Ralbag says the only problem here was a problem of arrogance. Gava. She wanted Tsarim Nechvadim Me'ela. She thought that she was worth more than that. The Malbim, though, takes things in a different perspective. He agrees, yes, Rashbam, Ralbag, they're correct. What's happening here is a different level of officials being sent. But the Malbim understands that Ahasuerus knows exactly what he's doing. He taps into something, and we're really going to come back to this idea at the end of this year, that Vashti is a descendant of the Babylonian monarchy. We talked last time about how Persia was really historically this Johnny-come-lately power. Persia, for hundreds and hundreds of years, had just been a bunch of nomads on the plateaus, in the east of out there in Iran. It was Babel, it was Ashur, who always had been the impressive royal empires. Persia as an empire is only a couple of generations old. They're still struggling to find their legitimacy. And there is this very deep, very widespread tradition that Vashti herself was a descendant of the royal house of Nebuchadnezzar. The Malbim understands that what's happening here at the beginning of the Megillah, we saw last week Rashi comment at the beginning that Ahasuerus is now in his third year established in his reign. And Rashi had the comment, finally, after 3 years on the throne, Ahasuerus is finally feeling secure. So the Malbim says what's happening politically is Ahasuerus is attempting to jettison Vashti. He wants to put her in her place. And he is now claiming, after using her, pedigree as the queen to legitimize his own rule, now he is asserting his own independence and saying, actually, I'm the one in charge. Hey, I have the army. I'm the Persian. They all listen to me. And I no longer need you for my legitimacy. And he has a number of diukim to boost this point. But for now, we're just going to identify a couple of them. Right. So one, he says this is exactly why Ahasuerus specifically sends sarisim. Sends lower level officials, because indeed it was an insult to Vashti. I'm dafka not sending you the senators. I'm dafka not sending you the generals. I'm sending you the in-house palace officials because you're nothing more than the wife of the glorious King Ahasuerus. There's nothing else. The Malbim has a very sharp inference besides that. Let's scroll up again to the psukim, right? We said, how much is there to extract from just four psukim? Well, watch this. Malbim points out, when Vashti was first introduced in the Megillah said, Gam Vashti Hamalka. Right? So it's Vashti the Malka. Okay, fine. Then we're told later on, Achashverosh commands, bring Vashti the queen. Okay. And then in Pasuk Yabez, we're told, Vatimain Hamalka Vashti. The queen, Vashti, refuses to come. Why is the order switched? Why do we see her as Vashti the queen, when she refuses to come? So the refusal is sent as Hamalka Vashti, the queen Vashti. Says the Malvim, that is a very intentional detail. Achashverosh specifically commanded, Vashti, who happens to be the queen, should come, right? But she's only the queen because she's my wife. She doesn't have any independent stature. And then Vashti, Vatimain Hamalka Vashti. Vashti responds, I'm the queen, and my name's Vashti, and I'm not coming. She understands what's happening. She reads the political move that Achashverosh is trying to pull, and will say, the mob is going to say, what, is Vashti crazy that she refuses the king? The answer is, basically, she's going to dare him, right? She's going to dare him to do something. You know, you're going to try to assert your independence from me. I don't think you have legitimacy. I don't think you can pull it off. And Achashverosh is claiming he's bringing her in front. Why is he bringing her in front of everybody for her beauty? Like, there are, what's the point of that? What's the point? The Malbim says, once again, it wasn't just, you know, silly Achashverosh, drunk Achashverosh, the weak, pathetic Achashverosh, who we kind of portrayed last week. He says, again, Achashverosh is making a political play. Because the message he's sending to everybody is, Shalom lakha ba'avor yichusa. Revisionist history. I never married Vashti for her yichus. I never married Vashti because of her Babylonian pedigree. Rak ba'avor yafya ki tavas mar'ehi. The only reason I married Vashti was because of her physical beauty. Other than that, there was nothing appealing to me. I never needed him. He's trying to assert his independence. And we can see now, you know, projecting forward in the Megillah, the same thing is going to happen with Esther. Why on earth is Achashverosh going to be okay with a queen who has absolutely no pedigree whatsoever? Now, we said historically, Achashverosh should certainly be sensitive to this, because his only personal legitimacy is that his mother was descended from Koresh. So he understands the value of pedigree of a wife. But connect, you know, creating this this facade, yet another Achashverosh facade, that he is totally independently powerful and totally independently legitimate. What better way to do that, the truth is going to be in the next parak, than by selecting a queen who has no pedigree at all. And literally her only claim to the throne is because the glorious, great king, emperor Achashverosh has made her the queen. So this approach of the Malvim is, it's a fantastic local diuk. It really sets up Achashverosh in a very particular politically scheming way, explains what's going to happen next parak. It explains why Vashti is daring him to do something, because she doesn't think that he can pull it off. And, you know, surprise, surprise, it doesn't work out for him. Right? So this is all one big school of thought. Now what's happening was, we focus on the Sarisim, there is a political message, and then either looking at Vashti as a personality in a derogatory sense, look at her, the petty ego of Vashti. Hey, so it was the Sarisim instead of the Partimim. Okay, not a big deal, get over it. No one's going to remember who it was who was sent to bring you. No one's going to remember that tomorrow. That's the Rabbah. The Malbim is saying, no, there's a political message over here, and Vashti is making a political decision. It was a bad political decision, but at least we can understand why she was doing it. That's major school number two. Major school number three, in some ways, this is the most surprising or interesting. Some of the modern Mepharshim really like to go in this direction, but you already have antecedents to this, even in the time of Chazal. It's to look at Vashti's behavior in a noble and even in a heroic fashion. The Rina Achmias, who is a student of the Rush, I believe. We also have his commentary to the Haggadah. So he writes on Megillah. They have now in the Toras Chaim Megillah Esther. And he actually says that the reason why Vashti didn't want to come to the party was because she says it's not gonna work out. It's gonna be an embarrassment for the king. It's like a tragic moment. Shelo yisbazeh hamelach b'mamaro. She's actually very concerned for Achashverosh. Suggests the reading of Mias. Ki iyashar lakol hamon ha'am sheyaskimu alah sheyitovas mareh. There's no way everyone's going to agree that Vashti is so beautiful. Achashverosh himself thinks though. But Vashti, sensitive, thinking, aware. It's a diverse crowd. Not everyone's going to agree to this. And she doesn't care for herself. You know, she's personally a very secure person. She doesn't need everybody at the party to think she looks beautiful. Her concern is shelo yitbazeh hamelach. Achashverosh is going to be the one who's going to come off looking bad. He's going to bring her to the party. And some people there are going to say, ah, I thought she, you know, she's not that beautiful. And the king will look bad. So Vashti was only trying to look out for her own beloved husband. Her beloved husband misunderstands, gets angry. Goodbye, Vashti. And it's a tragic moment. You know, we had a loving wife and a totally non-responding and kind husband. Okay. It's interesting. One approach. Now, it wasn't the Reed Nachmias was not the first person to develop this basic line of approach. The truth is, Medrash Rabbah, the Megillah, Esther Rabbah already has something similar. Megillah, the Esther Rabbah has a few lines that Vashti is saying to Achashverosh, and one of the ones is very, very similar to this. She says to him, look, you know, this is not wise. If they think that I'm beautiful, then they might assassinate you, which we said last week. We saw how Achashverosh was very, very paranoid about that. And if they think that I'm not beautiful, then you're going to look terrible. So again, the Medrash, Rina Nachmias, they're seeing Vashti in a sympathetic way. She's out there supporting her husband. The Mari, Kra, and the Ralbag, though, take things to an even greater level. They say we see Vashti's personal morality over here. Mari Kra says, Kol kavod the bas melach panima. She said, this isn't right. It's not proper. It's not, Ralbag says, modesty, that's neos. Ibn Ezra, the truth is, the same thing. Let's go to Ibn Ezra for a second. You know, we went straight to his second answer, the misunderstanding because she thought he was drunk. But the first thing he says is, Heus Vashti Amalchash Shemin Hagan Hashim Lehistater. Vashti came from a civilization where the women did not parade themselves out in public for everyone to look at. Vashti did not find that appropriate. So it was an act of modesty. And she's willing to stand on her principles. Aye, it's crazy. You don't say no to the king. What's going to happen? What happens, happens. Doesn't matter. It's not right. It's not appropriate. I'm not going to go out there in front of the whole crowd flaunting my beauty. I don't think that's an appropriate way to behave. And come what may, hey, whatever the consequences are going to be, they're going to be. I'm willing to bear them. I'm not going to violate my Vashti noble principles because of the threats that are coming from the king of Persia. That's what you get from Mari Kra, the Ralbag, the first answer of the Ibn Ezra. I think that Dat Mikra, some of the other modern Mepharshim point out as well, that this is highlighted by a surprising parallel between Yosef, who we're really going to talk about next week, and of all people, Vashti. When Yosef is solicited by the wife of Potiphar, and she tries and tries and tries to get Yosef to sleep with her, and what does Yosef finally do in the climactic moment? Vayima Ein, the shalshalas on there, because the tradition we have is that Yosef hesitated, but he pulls through. He refuses to come, right? He's told, come, 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 be with me. Vayima Ein, he refuses to come. No, I'm not going to give in. Same exact thing over here. Achashverosh invites Vashti. Come to a sexually inappropriate situation. She refuses to come. She refuses the invitation. What's going to be the consequence? One perspective is identical. The pshat for Vashti probably is, at least the simplest approach, is that Vashti wasn't killed. The simplest read of the psukim is that Vashti was banished. Vashti was imprisoned. Doesn't seem to be killed. I'm going to come back to this in a few minutes. We talk about Rashi. So if that's the case, if the result of refusing the invitation of the king is that Vashti is going to be imprisoned, it really is the same exact result that Yosef has. Yosef refuses the more powerful wife of Potiphar, and as a result, he finds himself in a dungeon for 12 years. And Vashti refuses the king of Persia, and she finds herself in a similar situation. But if the two of them had to do it all over again, Yosef and Vashti, there's no question that they both would have. You know, you told them, you have your principles. Are you going to cross them if you know what's going to happen to you? They would tell you, oh, that's life. You stick with your principles. So that is the most extreme pro-Vashti line of thinking. It's really, really interesting. It has a lot going for it. And all that does is highlight the question, why did Rashi go so far in the opposite direction? Right? The famous Rashi, which we will now try to explain and spend the rest of this year really unpacking this perspective. Because Rashi is not impressed with Vashti. He doesn't talk about her tznius. He doesn't talk about Vashti's courage. He doesn't talk about Vashti's political sensitivity. It's one of those weird Rashis. Rabbeinu Amru Lefi Sheparcha Ba Tziras Kedei Shatima Ein. So Rashi doesn't say that that Vashti grew a tail. Rashi says that Vashti all of a sudden got leprosy. She got tziras. Okay. Now that does explain why Vashti would not come. You know, I understand why she's not going to come if she's erupted in leprosy. But like, other than solving that specific problem of it's crazy for Vashti to not come, why is Rashi reading it this way? Why are we bringing in tziras, which there's obviously no mention in the psukim of this at all? Where is this whole idea coming from? Now, there's no question that Rashi is looking at Vashti in a very harsh light. And we're going to have to get to that in a couple of marmakomas. But first, let's just rebuild where the tziras comes from. And there are two steps to get there. The first is to understand a fascinating gematria. Rabbi Igdor Katz, one of the Rishonim from Ashkenaz, so he points out that the gematria of Vatimain Hamalka Vashti Lavo, the queen Vashti refused to come, the same gematria is Sheparcha Tzaras. I did the math, and it's the case. It's off by one. Gematria is off by one, 1352 versus 1353. All right, so that's cool. Now, I don't know if that's enough. You know, I don't know. Is one gematria really enough to explain, oh, that is why Rashi decided that we're going to drop this tziras on Vashti? Now, of course, it's not just Rashi, it's the Gemara. We're trying to understand the Medrash. So he quotes a Gemara, and this is what's really going to begin to unpack things for us. Now, we don't know where this Gemara is. Rashi and Tosfos quote this as a Yerushalmi. We do not have it in our Talmud Yerushalmi, but apparently there was a girsa of the Talmud Yerushalmi that was floating around in Ashkenaz. Rashi has it, Tosfos has it, Rabbi Vigdor Katz has it. And let's look at what it says. Yalafla b'gzera shava me uziya. So the tziras came from egzera shava. We have a similar pasuk by Uziyahu HaMelech, King Uziyahu. Okay, what is this? Shenemar v'yeshev beis hachavshis mitzora. So Uziyahu, after he attempts to burn Ketores in the Beis HaMikdash, he's not happy just being the king. He also wants to be the priest. So he tries to go into the Beis HaMikdash. He's immediately smitten with tziras on his forehead. He has to reside in, I guess, literally the vacation house, right? The free house. In other words, it's apart from everyone else. Mitzora, he is a leper. Ki nigzar mi beis Hashem. He was literally decreed, right? He was nigzar, he was banned mi beis Hashem. So what's the gzera shava? Uziyahu, we're told, is nigzar mi beis Hashem. And Vashti, we're told that Achashverosh remembers Es Asher Nigzar Aleha, that which was decreed against her. Now, what exactly is going on over here? Nigzar and Nigzar, is that really enough of a textual link to say that Vashti got tziras? So, to some degree, the answer is actually yes. The Bar Ilan, it's much easier to do this. You just, I guess you could use the concordance also. You search Nigzar in Tanakh. And actually, the word is only used three times. Once is Yeshaya Nun Gimel, which is a very difficult parak, which the Christians used for a long time. The other two are Vashti over here and Uziyahu. So it seems like, okay, that's interesting. Two contexts where this word Nigzar is being used, and maybe it's meaning to be banned. But if we look at actually what Uziyahu did, we can maybe understand what is the link between what his behavior with the Ketores and the Beis HaMikdash and that of Vashti. So Uziyah, we said, tries to come into the Beis HaMikdash, right? Vayavo el Heichal Hashem laktir al mizbach haKetores. He is illegally coming into the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohanim are coming after him. They don't want him to do it. They try to stop him. No, don't go. Lo lach Uziyah. Don't go. Don't go. Don't go. Leave the Mikdash. Kima'alta. It's a big deal. Uziyah refuses and he insists on coming into the Beis HaMikdash. And it is after he illegally goes where he wasn't supposed to go that he is stricken with tzaras. Ki nigzar mi Beis Hashem. Now, the Megillah, you know, one of the ironies the Megillah has is that it uses many Mishkan and Beis HaMikdash terms for Ahasuerus's palace and Ahasuerus's party. So just a couple of examples to think about. You know, there's only one other place we know of where the king, as it were, resides in the heart of the palace and nobody is allowed to visit them unless the king gives explicit permission. And if someone tries to come into the innermost chamber without permission, they are immediately killed. That's Parshas Achrimos, where the Torah says, Lo yavo b'chol leis el ha-kodesh. Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, even the Kohen Gadol, you know, the queen can't come in to visit the king, the Kohen Gadol can't come into the Kodesh HaKadoshim unless he's given the special permission, which he has one day per year. You know, we're going to get to 2 weeks from now, Parshas. This week is Parshas Yisro, so a couple weeks after that, Parshas Truma. And we're going to see all the materials, the Tcheles, the Argaman, which are all the gold, the silver, which are all used for the Mishkan. The other place in Tanakh where all those materials are described and described at length and described building a structure is Ahasuerus's palace. We had the Kelim Mikelim Shonim last week, right? The utensils of the Beis HaMikdash that Chazal are seeing in Ahasuerus's palace. Ahasuerus's palace is a total inversion, it's a toiva, it's like a twisted version of the Beis HaMikdash. We had one in Yerushalayim, now we have this total opposite of it in Shushan. But Chazal in this Yerushalmi seem to be looking at Uziyahu, who enters the real Beis HaMikdash illegally, looking at Vashti, who refuses to enter. It's like the exact opposite. Everyone's telling her, go, 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 go. And she's saying, no, I won't go. No, I won't go. No, I won't go into the palace. Uziyahu, everyone is telling him, don't go, don't go, don't go to the Beis HaMikdash. And he's saying, no, I'm going to go. No, I'm going to go. No, I'm going to go. And both of them are ending in that same result of the tzara'as erupting, says Rashi, says Chazal, right? The nigzar mi Beis Hashem. And they are ending with the same exact result, the same exact result of them being banned permanently. Now, Mari Kraft, for example, is one of the Mefarshim who says that the pshat is that what happened to Vashti is that Vashti was permanently banned. It was as if she was a leper. It really changes the Megillah when you think about it. Like, you know, Mordechai and Esther. Can you imagine Esther's life down in the palace, like knowing that somewhere down there is like the ghost of Vashti, like she's still stuck somewhere in some room. Okay, so now, okay, we're beginning to get. At least we understand the tzara'as piece, where it can come from. We have the gematria, we have the parallel between the Beis HaMikdash and Ahasuerus's palace, the proud refusal of Uziyahu, and the proud refusal, maybe, of Vashti. Okay, but is that enough? Is that enough for us to look at just the pshat of the psukim and see why Rashi and see why Chazal in a number of places would want to look at Vashti in a critical light? Why not go with the heroic perspective of the of the Mari Kraft from before and of the Ibn Ezra in one suggestion? Why go in this critical direction? So another major kind of two things to say, I guess. One is going to be very short and one is going to be more important. So the shorter one is Rava. You know, Rava in the Gemara and Megillah Yud Beis Amud Aleph. So he says, it's just amazing how he does this. I'm going to go one more time. I think this will be the last time tonight. that we have to go back to those few innocent psukim, or we said it before, like, what do we learn from Vashti? What do we learn? Four psukim, how much did we learn? So Rava says you have to look at the very first word of the story. Gam Vashti Hamalka Asasa Mashtei Nashim. So also Vashti made a party. Vashti also made a party. And she made Asasa Mashtei Nashim Beis Hamachus. And she makes a party in the royal house of Ahasuerus. Rava jumps on this, and Rava says in the Gemara, down here. So he says, first of all, it shouldn't have been Beis Hamalchus. It shouldn't have been in the royal house. It was in the Beis HaNashim. She was in the women's house. Both Ahasuerus and Vashti intended on doing the same thing. They both were looking for inappropriate sexual behavior. That's what Rava says. Gam Vashti Hamalka. Also Vashti. You look at Ahasuerus. Look at all the immorality of that world of the Persian parties in the first few psukim of the Megillah. Vashti and her party is all too comfortable, all too at home in that same worldview. The Mefarshim were saying Vashti wasn't comfortable, that tznius, the principled refusal. Rava says, baloney. I don't buy that pshat. I don't buy that take. Gam Vashti Hamalka. And she makes her own party for the women in the Beis Hamalchus, together with everyone else, right next door. The men, the women, they're getting drunk, they're cavorting. It's one giant free-for-all. There's no very modest men's party over here and a modest women's party over here. No, the Mishtein Hashim is in the Beis HaMalchus. It's a co-ed free-for-all. It's a total balagan. There's no hesitation. Ahasuerus is very comfortable doing what he's doing. Vashti is very comfortable doing what he's doing. This is not a morality. Not at all. So Vashti, if we're saying then, seems from that first word to be part and parcel of the culture of Persia. Okay, so now we can certainly maybe at least begin to understand why we have a more negative approach. But I still don't think it fully draws out the harshness of Rashi's line. And Rashi had one more thing, which I skipped over before because I wanted to focus on the tzaraas. But Rashi also said that what did she used to do? She would strip Jewish women, and she used to make them do malacha on Shabbos. I'm still struggling with this one. Where does this idea come from that Vashti was forcing Jewish women to do malacha on Shabbos? So one piece is that the Megillah does say that it was specifically on the seventh day. That's definitely a big piece. It was on the seventh day that Ahasuerus summons Vashti. So seventh day, if we assume is Shabbos. But I think what that's also beginning to do is it may be a bit of a hat tip to the major contrast that Vashti has in the Megillah. Who is the person who Vashti is contrasted with? It's not Ahasuerus. It's not. The Megillah goes out of its way to tell us multiple times. And if we scratch a little bit, we can find many, many other examples of this. The Megillah holds up Esther as the contrasting personality to Vashti. And once that's the case, once we appreciate that is so, that Esther is the opposite of Vashti, then by definition, we are going to look at Vashti in a negative light, right? You take any noble character trait of Esther, of which there are going to be many, you will then take the opposite of that and attribute it to Vashti. And now let's look at why you would do that. Just some of the links the two of them have, some of the counter, and then focusing on the key difference between the two of them. This will be the key point. So Megillah does tell us twice that Esther is set up as the replacement for Ahasuerus, for Vashti, right? The queenship will be given to her fellow who is better than she is. Not the same line, but not for now. When Esther is queen, the Megillah doesn't just say that she is selected as queen. The Megillah, for some reason, feels the need to tell us, Vayam lichaha tachas Vashti. Right? It was instead of Vashti that she was made the queen. Now it's not just that piece that the two of them are being linked in terms of the queen, and she is coming in to replace the queen Vashti. Their conduct, actually, the truth is in the Megillah, is strikingly similar on a number of fronts. Obviously, they're both queens. Their beauty is described. Megillah does not tell us about Zeresh being a particularly attractive woman. It is Vashti and Esther, right, who are the two beautiful women we have in the Megillah. they both make parties. Both Vashti and Esther are making. I mean, the only thing Vashti did in Megillah was make a party, and Esther obviously does that as well. They're also the only two people in Megillah who defy the will of the king. Vashti, in opposite ways, Vashti defies the will of the king by refusing to come, and Esther defies the will of the king by coming when she's uninvited. But they're the only two people who refuse the open command, the open law of the king. Chazal, we know that Esther is an orphan. We're told that in Megillah. Chazal have a tradition that Vashti was orphaned as well. Again, we talk about this very strong tradition of Vashti being the descendant of the fallen house of Nebuchadnezzar. And if we talk about Vashti she's not just an orphan, but Vashti as an orphan of a fallen royal house, an ancient royal house, just like Esther. Because what's the ancient royal house, the fallen royal house, which Esther descends from? The house of Shaul. So there's actually a lot that Vashti and Esther, these two queens, have in common. A lot. This is like a little bit in jest, but I kind of wonder, you know, the classic medrash about Esther having the yellow complexion, you know, that Esther's skin was a little bit off. You got to wonder, are we seeing that? Hey, even Vashti has her skin issues and Esther has her skin issues. Got to wonder. The last one is that Esther is also compared to Rachel. Sorry, it's also compared to Yosef. We're going to explore more of this next week. We actually talk about Esther. But Yosef, Rachel, and Esther are the three people in Tanakh who are described as being beauty of form and beauty of appearance. Yifas Tar v'Tovas Mar'eh was Esther. Yosef, in the build-up to that same story of the wife of Potiphar, was described as Yifas Tar v'Yifas Mar'eh. And Rachel, Yosef's mother, Yifas Tar v'Yifas Mar'eh. So we saw before, the Megillah had some Yosef language for Vashti. It has some Yosef language for Esther. It's interesting that we have Rachel to think of as well. You know, if you, let's put it this way. Let's put a pin in Rachel for a second. All those links that Vashti and Esther have, the Megillah linking them, their queens, the beauty, the parties, the refusal of the order of the king, moving into the Midrashim, orphans from a royal house, the links, the textual links to Yosef, 5, 6, 7, 8 links we can come up with right away between Esther and Vashti. What does it point to? It points to the one key contrast, which is what do Vashti and Esther do in the moment of crisis? And here is the key point. The moment of crisis, they need to violate the law of the king. Vashti, for whatever calculation she has, and Esther, because she has to save the Jewish people. What do? Vashti just relies on her own charisma, her own power, her own self. There's nothing for Vashti beyond her own power. She doesn't appeal to anything else. Fatima Ain, right? A noble, heroic, courageous stand. But that's it. What does Esther do? What does Esther do in the moment of crisis? It is like the most... It's the most Hashem comes into the Megillah in the whole story, basically. We're going to fast. We're going to daven. And by the way, it's not just going to be me. I need the Ribbono Shel Olam, and I also need all the tfilos of all of Klal Yisrael. In other words, Esther has the bitachon and emuna, obviously, and simultaneously the humility to realize she can't do it all by herself. She can't do it all by herself physically, politically. She can't even do it all by herself religiously, spiritually. She knows she needs the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which she hopes and has faith that she can get. And she also needs the help of all of Klal Yisrael to be davening together with her. Right? That is at the moment of truth. When Vashti and Esther face a similar situation, Vashti just goes by herself, and Esther immediately turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and turns to the Zechus of all of Klal Yisrael. But her frame of reference is a Hashem-centered one. There's no God in the worldview of Vashti, Just like there's no God in the worldview of Ahasuerus or of Haman or of anybody in the whole Persian royal realm. There's no God over there. Only Esther has it. That is the key difference, I think, between Esther and Vashti. All those parallels are building that up. Now, if we think about Rachel for a second, right? So a few weeks ago, you know, for those who came to the, when we did the Bracious parallel shiur, so we talked about Rachel. We saw what was the defining element of Rachel was Rachel's tefillah. Rachel, in many ways, was actually the first of the imaus, for sure. She was the first of the imaus, we said, to be documented davening for a child. That happened not only one time in the Torah, but actually three. The Chumash referenced Rachel's prayers for Yosef. He listened to her. And the Torah also had those references before the births of Dan and of Naphtali. The birth of Dan, when Rachel says, "Vegam shama bekoli," Hashem has listened to my voice. And the birth of Naphtali, when Rachel says, "Naftulei Elokim niftalti," where Rashi is a machlokas with the unkelus. But either way, either it means I was exceptionally stubborn in my prayer, nisakashti vetzarti asiros, I was exceptionally stubborn and over the top with my davening, or unkelus who says, "Naftulei Elokim," means I prayed. Either way, tefillah in crisis is the hallmark of Rachel, and that has been inherited by her great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter, Esther, the descendant of Binyamin, the son of Rachel. Okay, that, I think, is the key difference. And that's why, if you want to know why we have a harsh perspective on Vashti, she fits into the Persian milieu, and that is a milieu where there is no Hashem. And all those links that Vashti has with Esther all point to that one key contrast. You have to dig to find it, like you have to dig to find so many things in the Megillah, but once you see it, you can't deny it. That's the only difference between them in the Megillah, is what do they do? But that difference makes all of the difference. And with that, let's just take 5 minutes to finish up and look at a couple of really, really interesting lines that Chazal have. I think it's going to take this just, you know, to the last step. The Gemara is an interesting thing. You know, apparently when the Amoraim would begin giving shir about the Megillah, so they always like to open up. The Gemara has like a number of lines like that. This Amora had is his go-to opening for his Megillah shir. So one of them here is Rabbi Yonasan, who would begin the Megillah shir quoting a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu Parak Yud Gimel Parak Yud Dalet is Yeshayahu's prophecy of the eventual destruction of the kingdom of Babylonia. And the pasuk there says, Yeshayahu tells everybody, "Hechrati the Babel Shem Ushar Nin Benechet. I will wipe off from Babel a name, a remnant, a grandson, and a great grandson." Right. So, what exactly are all those things? Rabbi Yonasan says, "What are we going to wipe off? Shem Zak Sav, no one's going to use their writing anymore. Sha'ar Zelashon, I don't know, do you know anybody who speaks Babylonian? I don't know anybody who speaks Babylonian. Nin, people speak, Aramaic, no one speaks Babylonian. Nin Zemalchus, they will lose their kingdom. The Neched Zel Vashti. Last thing which is going to be cut off is going to be Vashti." That's when he began his Megillah. Okay, let's come back to that. Zelapasik, which may sound familiar because we read it on fast days. Tachasana tzutz yaleh berosh, instead of the thorn, we're going to have the cypress. Tachasa serpad yaleh hadas, instead of the bramble, we're going to have the myrtle bush. Vayasham l'shem lo salam lo yikaris. Okay, so what are these things? So if we look from an Esther perspective, so we might say, okay, we can predict one of the four. I don't know what he's doing with Megillah's Esther, but whatever is going to happen, I know that Tachas hasirpad yaleh hadas. The hadas here is probably going to be hadasa hi Esther. So let's see, what does the Gemara say? And then we got to unpack what it means. Avshor Rachmani is next on the Gemara. So what did he? How did he open the? How did he open his shir? Tachas hanatzutz yaleh berosh. Tachas hasirpad yaleh hadas. Tachas hanatzutz, instead of the thorn, tachas haman harasha. The thorn bush is Haman, who made himself a avodah zarah, and a avodah zarah is referred to as a thorn bush. Okay. So who's going to be instead of Haman? Obviously, Yaleh Berosh, Zeh, Mordechai. Mordechai was called the head of spices, of Besamim, and Besam is called Mordechai. Okay, fine. That's not so crazy. I understand that one. right? We're saying Tachas Haman is Mordechai. What's surprising, though, is the next line of the Gemara, where the Gemara continues with the Pasuk, Tachas HaSirpad, instead of the, whatever, the other briar bramble. Instead of Tachas Vashti HaRisha'a, right? It's called a Sirpad because of burning, Saraf. It's a very flammable little bush. And of course, who's associated with burning? Ruchanetzar. So instead of Vashti, we're going to have Astaras HaNikras Nikres Hadasa. Okay. Now, you know, in a vacuum, I could read the Gemara and I can say, I can understand why you would set up Haman and Mordechai. I can understand why you would set up Vashti and Esther. But when you put them together into one pasuk, what the Gemara here is doing is putting Vashti and Haman in the same category, right? We have Mordechai and Esther, and we don't just have, you know, Vashti, the random Persian queen. We have Vashti together with Haman. Now, what's going on over here? So, A, I think given what we've seen, we can totally understand this. The whole idea of Amalek, Mikre, chance, choice, no divine providence, no Ashkacha, no Hashem in the world. Haman just casts lots, he casts Purim to decide what's going to be the fate. That is exactly the worldview of Vashti as well. It turns out that Vashti and Haman really come from the same exact worldview. Right? And so we indeed have the two of them on one side, because the question in the Megillah is, do you see the hidden hand of Hashem or do you not? On the one hand, we have Haman and we have Vashti. Their moments of crisis, yeah, they're all in themselves. On the other hand, we have Mordechai and Esther who see the hidden hand of Hashem and are constantly reaching out when that is needed. That's piece number one. Well, let's just close with the other piece, which is, I think, just deepen this a little more, that Chazal are also drawing out. Why the insistence on referencing Vashti's Babylonian heritage, right? That earlier Gemara, which talked about the first thing you need to know about the Megillah, the first thing you need to know is that Babylonia is being wiped off. Who cares about Babel? Babel's gone. We begin the Megillah with Persia. Right. Why is the first thing I need to know about Bavel being gone if Bavel doesn't even appear in the story? They're irrelevant. The answer is they're not irrelevant at all, because the same exact worldview that Nebuchadnezzar stood for is the one which is the beating heart of the Megillah. We could say that Nebuchadnezzar himself may be gone, but his ideology survives in his great-granddaughter Vashti, and it survives in the new kingdom which has come to take their place. The idea that I am the God, there is no greater power. Well, I mean, that was exactly Nebuchadnezzar, of course. You know, does this story sound familiar? Nebuchadnezzar making a golden statue and making everybody have to bow down to his golden statue, which Rabbi Natam already said wasn't supposed to be a god. It wasn't an idol, Nebuchadnezzar's golden statue. It was a representative of himself, right? Nebuchadnezzar makes a giant statue of himself made out of gold, which everyone needs to bow down to. It's exactly what Haman does a couple of generations later. The person is, when you don't have a God in the world, what these people are worshiping, Haman, Nebuchadnezzar, and now we're suggesting Vashti, is they are worshiping themselves. In that same chapter of Yeshaya, when he has the pasuk which the Gemara quoted about Nebuchadnezzar, about Babel being wiped off, culminating in the destruction of Vashti, so Yeshaya makes fun of this ridiculous arrogance that the Babylonians had. Where Yeshaya portrays, he says, you thought you were going to rise up to Shemayim, Ata Marta Bilvavcha, Hashemayim Eleh, Mimala Kochavei El, I'm going to be above the stars, I'm going to be above the clouds, Eleh Abamase Av, and now you're gone. Now you are nothing. Totally collapsed, totally destroyed, with no future whatsoever. That arrogance, that spiritual arrogance of Babel lives on in Persia, right? And what the Gemara wants us to do is realize, hey, what happened to these two queens? Look at the irony at the end. Vashti and Esther, we said, were both the last, right? They were both the last member of a great royal house, the house of Babel and the house of Shaphat. Except, what happens with Vashti? Vashti, who does not move past the ideology of her family, and rather it gets imported into the whole Megillah as a whole, the worldview of Nebuchadnezzar, becomes the worldview of Persia. First thing you need to know is that she's gone. It's an end. The people who held themselves up as rising up to Shemayim and beyond are wiped out. There is nothing left. Nobody speaks Babylonian. No one reads Babylonian. There's no Babylonian kingdom, and there is no Vashti. Those who hold themselves up so high have no future. And who is the ultimate contrast to that is Esther. What does Esther tell Chazal? Kisvuni Ladoros, right? The story has to be written down, and it has to be written down for generations, for all time. The Rambam says that in the time of Mashiach, we may wipe off a whole bunch of Tanakh, but Megillas Esther is going to last for all time. Esther telling us that those who have the humility, those who have the Amunah, you may be the queen of Persia, but realizing it's not all about me, I can't do it. The whole world looks at things from a secular perspective, but I realize that the one really running the world is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I realize that I am constantly in the need of his help and of his assistance. That is the path to a true lasting future. So Esther is not just the, you know, survivor of the royal house, but this we'll probably get into next week, how Esther is going to rebuild the fallen house of Shaul. The two roads, one leading to oblivion, that being the road of Vashti, that being the worldview of the Megillah, the worldview of Nebuchadnezzar, Ahasuerus, Persia, Babel. And in contrast, the worldview of Esther, the worldview of Mordechai, the worldview of Amunah and Bitachon. And so that is why I think we can understand why Rashi would look at Vashti and see someone who is so comfortable in the worldview of Persia. And that person who is so comfortable in the worldview of Persia has absolutely no future, just like ultimately everybody else surrounding her, except for Mordechai and Esther. So we'll stop here. Hope everybody enjoyed, and we're looking forward to more learning next week.